This is tape 4, principle 1, create a safe environment. In this part, Len explains how to make it safe for others to cooperate with us. This principle is important because our levels of thinking constrict as we feel threatened or unsafe. If we feel threatened enough, we begin acting like preschoolers. Thus, making it safe for others is especially important in dealing with people in the forcer level of thinking. But it also applies to every negotiation we have with others. The more safe we can help others feel, the more likely they will be able to listen to us and cooperate with us instead of becoming defensive and reacting to us. Handout number 9, Taking the Bull Out of the Bully, will give you an outline to follow for this tape.
So let's talk now about the first principle, how to create a safe environment with others. As Tom said, what is important about this is that our levels of thinking expand and constrict depending upon how safe or threatened we feel. So this is a particularly important principle when we're dealing with people in lower levels, earlier levels of thinking, when they're in enforcer or scorekeeper thinking. But it's also true anytime we're dealing with another person. You know, what can we do to help them be able to listen to us and not be defensive, rather than making them constricted and pushing them away? Let me talk about that first of all, particularly in terms of enforcers. What do we need to do to make it safe so that when we or others are in enforcer levels of thinking, we can get out of that? Because that's not a productive place to be. When I find myself there, what I need to do is make it as easy as possible for myself in the moment. I need to take care of myself. I need to be gentle with myself. It is not a time to shape myself up. It is not a time to test myself to see how much I can endure. It's not a time to push myself. It's a time to make it easy for myself. So if you need a break, take a break. If you need to go be with someone, go be with someone. If you need a nap, go take a nap. If you need an ice cream cone, go get an ice cream cone. If you need to go for a walk, go for a walk. Whatever it is you need, give it to yourself. Make it easy. And in the same way, when you find other people in this level of thinking, sometimes, especially if they're withdrawn out of fear, you need to find ways in the short term to make it easy for them, to take care of them so that they can grow up again. Well, if you're dealing with somebody in this stage who's being aggressive, who's coming out of their anger, who's attacking or threatening, then there's a two-step process that you need to go through. And the first step is that you need to get their attention. The reason you need to get their attention is because they're egocentric. They're lost in themselves. They're not aware of what's going on with you. Remember, you're just an object. So you need to get their attention. They need to know, they need to experience that they have to deal with you, that they can't ignore you. So in some way, you need to draw a boundary of consequence. You need to find some way for them to know that they can't just run over you. We have many ways of drawing boundaries of consequence. We do it most often by what we say and by our tone of voice. So when I say to you, this is the last time this is going to happen, I won't tolerate this anymore, this is it, and I mean it, you know it. On the other hand, when I say to you, gee, I wish you wouldn't do that. This isn't very comfortable. I wish you wouldn't do this. What you hear from me is me whining. What you hear is, well, he wants me to do this some more. What's important is that other people always know the difference. They know when we mean the boundary, and they know when we don't. Anybody that's, again, had kids, how many times have you had kids in the backseat of the car creating havoc, and you say, you know, kids, knock it off. I wish your kids would knock it off. And of course, they do it more and more. But when you stop and grab them by their shirt collar and put their nose an inch from yours and say, look, bucko, this is it. Knock it off. And they know you mean it. They knock it off. I have a great story that I've told for years, and actually it's a true story, though it's always hard for me to tell after I've told a story for years how much of it's still true and how much I've imagined over the years. Some years ago, I worked with a medical clinic, and two of the partners were a married couple, Harold and Helen, and they were in their 50s. And they had been having some conflict with themselves. So I'd been doing work at the clinic, and then they asked if they could see me and talk to me about their own relationship. Now, Helen was this very attractive, bright, articulate, engaging 55-year-old woman. But the interesting thing that happened is that whenever she talked to or about Harold, her voice changed. Her voice became this kind of complaining whine where she kind of talked through her nose. So I had had some sessions with them, and they had complained about each other, and nothing much was coming of it. They were just blaming each other. Or more particularly, Helen was complaining about Harold, and Harold was just sort of disappearing and being a nice guy. And I had seen Helen a couple of times on her own. And I had tried to point out to her what her voice sounded like, and had in fact written out a description of the pattern that went on between them. And the pattern that went on between them is that Harold somehow could never do it right, or he never did enough, or he never did it fast enough. And she would get into this tone of voice with him about how much he disappointed her, the way her father had disappointed her. So I had taped her voice and fed it back to her. I had outlined the pattern to her. But what was clear was that she really didn't want to change. There was no commitment on her part to really resolve it. She really wanted me to side with her, to sort of couple front with her, to beat up on Harold. And since I didn't see that as very enjoyable or very productive, at some point I decided to draw a boundary with her, and I said to her, I will not make another appointment with you because I don't perceive that you're ready to really make any changes. If at some point you decide that you really want to do your own work instead of coming in here and just talking about Harold and what's wrong with him, I'll be happy to do that with you. But as for today, I don't want to make another appointment. That infuriated her. She tried to get another appointment. I told her I wasn't willing to do that. She left angrily and slammed the door. So I knew on some level I had her attention. So the next afternoon she calls me. And she said that she had gone home and she had told Harold just what I had said about him, which had been nothing. So she'd gone home and set it up. And what had happened, which was, had happened traditionally, repeatedly in their relationship, is that she would whine and complain at Harold for a period of time. He would be a nice guy, but then at some point he'd reach his limit and he'd explode. And he'd physically and verbally push her around. And that had happened the night before. She had gone home, she had gotten on to him, and he had pushed her around, and he had gone to bed, and Helen had had enough. And she went in the kitchen and got her biggest cast iron skillet, and went in and woke him up, skillet over his head, and said, "You ever touch me again, I'm going to kill you in your sleep." Harold believed her. Harold had trouble sleeping. Harold came in to see me, and Harold and Helen managed to work out their differences and figure out a different way to do that. The story makes a good point. The fact is, Helen finally reached a point where she decided to do something different. Notice that in drawing her boundary with her husband, she didn't hit him. She didn't punish him. She didn't pay him back. She was not aggressive towards him. She simply drew a boundary that she meant and that she intended to keep. And he knew the difference. On their honeymoon, she had complained that she was going to leave him some 25 years before. But of course, she never did, and he never believed her. But when she said she had had enough, and the skillet provided a nice symbol to convince him of it, he believed her. Most often, our tone of voice and what we say is all the boundary that we need. But we also need to recognize that sometimes we need skillets. Sometimes our tone of voice is not enough. Sometimes I need to hang up the phone, walk out of the room, send a certified letter, file a lawsuit, cancel the contract, put the person on probation. I need to take some decisive action that lets the other person know that I'm serious about this and that I intend to keep the boundary. Once I have drawn the boundary, the second step in dealing with people in enforcer or lower levels of thinking is that I need to find some way to help them feel safer so that they, in fact, can grow up again. And that leads us to our first principle of creating a safe environment. There are many ways that I make it safe for others. Probably the primary way that I make it safe for others to cooperate with me is when I listen to them. Listening to other people allows them to feel understood. It allows them to feel validated, respected. It takes care of those basic needs that we talked about in an earlier session. Listening is a very powerful tool for creating safe environments for others. And the important thing about active listening, where I actually verbally feed back to the other person what I hear them saying, is that it slows down the dialogue between us. Be aware that as we feel threatened, as we become embattled with other people, that we normally start talking faster and we start talking louder. If I will slow down the pace of what I'm doing, of what I'm saying, if I will talk quieter, then I will contribute to creating a safer environment. I will give the other person time to think. I will not make them feel rushed and in a hurry and like they don't have time to listen to me, but need to be planning their defense while I'm talking. And the same is true for me in terms of planning defenses, is that I need to take the time to listen to other people instead of planning my defense while they're talking. Other things that make it safe for others is being aware of, again, going back to the issue of being right versus understanding, being aware of what's going on in my own chest, being aware of whether I want to beat them or want to convince them that they're wrong, or do I really want to understand them. The other person always knows the difference of what's going on inside of me. A third way that I make it safe for other people is to be aware of who their constituency is. Be aware that everybody always has a constituency. They always have people to whom they need to look good or be successful for. So if I'm negotiating with one of my sons, and if I want him to do something that's going to make him look foolish to his friends, I'm not likely going to get his commitment. Or if I'm dealing with somebody else at work, and if I expect them to go back to their department looking like a failure, or looking like they gave up the ship, or looking like they didn't stand up for what they needed to stand up for, or if I'm going to send them back and they're going to have to ask their people to do something that's really distasteful to them, then clearly I'm not sending them back to a very safe environment. I need to be aware of who other people's constituencies are. And how can I send them home being a hero? How can I make it easy for them to go back and do what it is that they need to be doing? I need to also ask myself the question of, can I afford to understand them? I remember some years ago I was doing a workshop in the East Coast, and a woman in the group, and I was talking about the principle of understanding, and she said, but I've got a 16-year-old daughter and I don't want to understand her. I said, so help me understand what you mean by that. You know, what do you think it'll cost you if you understand her? He said, and the woman's response was, well, she's really unhappy and I think she's really depressed and I'm afraid it's my fault. So the fear sometimes in understanding is a fear that something's been our fault, or that we're to blame for something, or that we're going to have to do something that we don't want to do. But my experience is that not understanding doesn't make any of those issues go away. That only when I'm willing to understand the truth, the reality, am I able to do something about correcting what I need to correct. And sometimes that means being accountable for what I've done in the past. My experience is that I have never lost anything by understanding another person. And I have lost a great deal whenever I have not been willing to understand another person. Because it's caused me then, when I have not understood, to act in inappropriate ways, to protect myself in overcompensating ways, and to produce results that I really don't want with other people. Another way that we make it safe for other people is being aware of the kind of language that we use, being aware of our tone of voice. I have frequently gotten feedback that I come across as harsh or impatient with people. And what I was aware of for years is that people sometimes got defensive with me and I didn't understand why until somebody felt safe enough with me to say, "You really sounded harsh when you said that." You know, if you said that in a different tone of voice, they probably wouldn't have reacted. So it's important to be aware of the tone of voice we use and how we sometimes come across that we're not aware of, or how we may sometimes be impatient on the phone because we've got something else on our mind. And I need to be aware of how I ask questions. We have a tendency oftentimes to ask why questions. Well, the word why or why questions are interesting in our culture because parents have a tendency to ask rhetorical questions of kids. They're not really questions. They're really statements of judgment that are intended to make the other person feel small or guilty, to guilt them into doing what we want them to do. And rhetorical questions usually begin with why. So why did you do that? Now, what would make you think of that? Be aware that the implied ending on every rhetorical why question is the word stupid. And you may not say the word, but the other person hears it. It is possible to ask factual why questions, that I really want information. It's very important that I know the difference in myself of whether I'm really asking for data or information or whether I'm really stating a judgment in a sneaky rhetorical why question. In general, I think the why questions are dangerous, that because of our experience of having them used against us in life, that people typically react to them. You might try it out yourself today. Go ask somebody a why question and see if, in fact, and ask it as a real question, and see if, in fact, you really get a quantitative factual response, or if what you get is a defensive response. I think why questions generally trigger people into being about 8 years old. A more effective way to ask our questions is to ask what. So help me understand what happened. Give me the information about, you know, what went on. Ask what, not why. And be aware that sometimes we ask sneaky why questions like, "What would make you do that, stupid?" Be sure that we're not really asking why in the form of what, or using the term how come. How come can be another form of why. So be aware of your questions. Be aware of how they impact other people, sometimes unintentionally. Another thing to be aware of in terms of making it safe for us is to be aware of your time focus. We always have a time focus in our negotiations. We're either talking about the past, or we're talking about the present, or we're talking about the future. When I talk about the past, especially if there has been any or there is any conflict or discord between myself and the other party, if there is some history of conflict or distrust, then in talking about the past, what we frequently are doing is getting into a posture of being right, and we're trying to blame the other person for what has happened. We try to blame others for who did it first or who did it last or who didn't do it or who did it the most. But one way or the other, we get into a blame game, and it doesn't go anyplace. We simply dig ourselves into a grave with each other. It is oftentimes critical, and again, it goes back to the issue of being right versus understanding, that I check in myself. And if I find myself wanting to be right, that I stop and ask myself the question, is there any reason for me to have a future relationship with this person? And if so, what do I want that relationship to look like? And what do I need to do to make that happen? It's a way to shift myself into trying to understand, into having some real commitment to make it safe and to achieve resolution, to reach agreement with the other person and not just beat them. And oftentimes I need to raise that verbally, that same question verbally with the other person. I need to say to them, "Do you perceive that there's any reason for us to have a future relationship? Do you want to be in a relationship with me, whether it's personally or professionally? And what do you want our relationship to be like? How would you like it to be between us? And what are you willing to do with me to make that happen?" Making it safe oftentimes means taking the time to help others imagine the possibility of something different than what we've had up to now. because we frequently continue repeating non-productive, non-safe patterns of behaviors with others because we don't let ourselves imagine what else might be possible. That's a way, it's a critical way that we create safety with others, is to get us out of the past and to move us into the present, into the future, by raising the question of, what do we really want here? Do we want what we've had, or do we want something different? It's also important to be aware of whether or not I shut off other people when they're feeling strong emotions, or whether I give them permission and the space and the time to vent them. If somebody really gets into strong emotions of fear or sadness or anger, sometimes it makes us uncomfortable. Sometimes we try to make them go away. We say, well, that's not really important, or let's let it pass, or you shouldn't really feel that way, or there's nothing to be afraid of. We invalidate them. We deny their experience because we're uncomfortable with their experience. And yet if we do that, what we do is that we trap them. We cause them to be locked up at that early age that those emotions are coming from. On the other hand, if I can provide them with the time and space, the safe environment to vent those emotions, it releases them. It allows them to grow up in the moment. It allows them to name their experience and to get it outside of them rather than having it churn around inside of them. That this process of naming our experience allows us to take things outside of us, and it gives it external shape and definition. It allows us to look at it differently, to turn it around, to see it from different angles. It gives us options to do something with it. The ghosts that we don't name continue to chase us within and continue to chase us in our relationships with others. But the ghosts that we're able to name and put outside of us, we can begin to heal. We experience release and relief and a natural movement forward. So one of the very powerful things that you can do to make things safer for you is to state what your fears and feelings and concerns are with others, and to give others permission to do the same with you, to provide an environment where others can name their ghost, can name what they're feeling, can name their experience, and get it outside of them so you can move on. It doesn't mean you need to be victimized by it. It just means that you need to be able to name it to release it. And that raises another issue about creating safe environments, and that is, creating safe environments absolutely does not mean that you should ever allow yourself to be victimized by others. Other people have a right to be angry, and they have a right to be angry about things that you have done that have impacted them in some important way. But they do not have a right to punish you, and that's different. So if somebody is going to tell you for the third time, or when you ask them the question of, is there a reason for us to have a future relationship, or do you want something different, and they say, I don't know, and what they want to do is keep going back to the old stuff again, then it is appropriate to cut that off. It's appropriate to draw a boundary with the other person. It's appropriate to say to them, I understand that you're angry, and to reflect back to them what you hear they need that's beneath their anger, that their anger is about. Because anger is always expressing something that somebody needs, some vulnerable feelings. So it's important to reflect back to them what you really hear that they need, and to respect what they need, but also make it clear to them you're not willing to be punished by them. And if they're willing to address their needs and work towards some resolution or solution, you'd like to do that with them. But you're not going to just keep going around the same track and allowing them to punish you, because that's not productive for you, and it's not productive for them either. Another point about making it safe is, be aware that some people are what's called extroverts, and other people are what we call introverts. And I use that not in the way that we normally think of that in social context, but as it's used in Jungian psychology, that people take in data and process it differently. Introverts think to speak. So when something goes on with them, they need to take in their data, and they need time to go off and think about it before they respond to the other person. Extroverts, on the other hand, speak to think. They think out loud. They think by talking or by writing something out, by externalizing it. Well, guess what? Introverts and extroverts drive each other nuts sometimes, and they make it unsafe for each other. It's amazing how many introverts and extroverts marry each other and become business partners. Introverts become threatened because extroverts keep talking at them and keep giving them more data and overwhelm them, and they want immediate responses that they can't give them. And they hear extroverts thinking out loud, and they sometimes confuse the extroverts' out loud thinking with commitments. My son Andy and I have gone through that a lot because I tend to be more extroverted than him. So I might come home and say, I'm thinking about buying a new car. You know, I looked at Volvos today. And I come home the next day and say, well, you know, I'm thinking about now maybe I'll buy a Subaru. And he said, you can't buy a Subaru. You said you're going to buy a Volvo. And I'll say, I never said I was going to buy a Volvo. I said, I was thinking about it. No, you said you're going to buy one. Have you found yourself having those kinds of conversations? And extroverts get frustrated with introverts because they misinterpret the introvert's need to go off and thinking about it, with the introvert sometimes being sneaky or avoiding. So if you're an extrovert, you need to give introverts time to think. And if you're an introvert, you need to let extroverts know what you're thinking about, because they can't read your mind. So I invite you to look at all the ways that you may tend to make it unsafe for others to do what you really need for them to do. And in your workbook, once again, there is an application exercise to help you do this. If you will look at exercise number 10, called Create a Safe Environment Worksheet. Again, it identifies some examples of ways that people tend to not make it safe for others. I invite you to brainstorm a list for yourself. What are your favorite ways of making it unsafe for others? What are your favorite ways of protecting yourself? What do you do when you get defensive? And then identify some examples of where you've used these behaviors and what you've done or not done, and the kind of results it's produced for you. Spend some time being accountable and honest with yourself about what your typical patterns are of making it unsafe for others. And think about, in the situations where you have not gotten the results you wanted from others, what you can do to make it safe and easy for others to do what you need them to do when you need them to do it.
This is the end of tape 4.